Evening, good evening, good evening. My name is Winston Class, and I'm the coordinator of PCC and Toronto Awareness Nights. And this is our second session for the year. I knew it was going to come to this with all of the advances and the deep screening in terms of prostate cancer research. It's going to take three people now to make a good presentation. I don't know. I didn't think it was going to happen 10 years from now, the pace at which things are going. I'd like to make some announcements, first of all, before I get to some housekeeping announcements, before I get to the business of tonight. I'd like to thank Bank of Nova Scotia, the sponsors of Awareness Night. They've been very generous over the years with us, and once more, I'd like to thank them for their support. Announcement about the washroom is very important. Through the main door and to the right, the washrooms are there just in case you need to go there. I just want to get an idea of who are here for the first time. If you could just put your hands up. Thank you very much. An announcement about the video taken between you and our specialist needs a backup, and if there is anyone in the audience who feels that they can fill that role, we'd be happy to have you meet them and work with them. So we're looking for a backup with you, people. That's the right word for it. Because Jerry has got to go on holidays sometimes, and, we need somebody to do it while he's away. So, bear that in mind. Next announcement is that we have a support group for, we call it Advanced Prostate Cancer Support Group. This group, we feel, has needs that are a bit different from the needs for the regular session. And we've been around forming this group and getting it developed over the last year or so. And if you know anyone who might be in need of that type of support, I suggest that you get them to, if you come to me, I can give you my email address, and you can take it from there. You've got that person to introduce themselves to the group and benefit from the advice that you can get from people who've been through it. Okay? Next, I'd like to call on Aaron Backer, Media Class Chairman, to make an announcement.
Thanks, Milton. So when they call me up here, it's usually to tell you about some event that we're taking, that we're involved with. And once again, this year on Father's Day, June 19th, Sunday morning, our group is going to be taking part in Prostate Cancer Canada Father's Day Walk Run. And it's at Ashbridge's Day this year. We're not a fundraising organization, but once a year, we do try and raise some funds for prostate cancer research, education, and awareness. So the Walk for Dad is our annual event. I hope you all got the yellow sheet that was on the table. If not, it'll be there at the break. Excuse me, at the coffee break. Please pick one up. There's just some very easy instructions on how you can join our team. We have two teams already formed on the Prostate Cancer Canada's website to raise some funds. And we ask you to join our team, and then we ask you to email your friends, family, peers, and have them donate in your name. A separate page will be set up on the website. They donate money and funds in your name. And that money that's raised is raised for research, education, and awareness. A bonus for the support groups is that when Prostate Cancer Canada gets this money, the part that they allot for awareness and education, they look to the people who do that best, and that's the support groups across Canada. We do that all the time, as do all the other support groups. So what they do is they give us back 50% of what we raise to let us go on with the work that we do as far as awareness and education. So it also allows us to sustain ourselves. We're a nonprofit, we're always fighting for next year's budget. So we ask you to first pick up a sheet, a yellow sheet of paper, learn how to join our team. If that's something that you find that you can do, but you'd like like to make a donation to Prostate Cancer Canada, if you know our name, name of our group, will be set up at the back of the break, and you'll be able to do that, and tax receipts will be received by you in due time.
Okay, I do believe that there's a lot to be benefited from this evening's presentation. One of the reasons is that the landscape seems to be shifting ever so much from month to month in terms of prostate cancer research. In my day, it was a question of just, so you diagnose and you get treated. And what's happening now is that we are pulling back a little bit more from treatment and putting a lot more focus on the diagnosis end of it. And because of that, the decisions are a bit more nuanced. And we as a support group, we need to keep up with this. And I'm hopeful that this presentation would provide some sort of foundation, some sort of solid guidelines in terms of what is on changing and what is changing, so we can separate the wheat from the chaff and give some good advice. I'm going to introduce you to Dr. Buckley, who's going to be presenting tonight, in his own words, and then I'm going to get him to introduce two other doctors who will be working with him, a pathologist and a radiologist, to help us understand this whole journey. Prostate cancer journey. Up to about half an hour ago, I was assigned to do the introduction for your support team. But we worked out something that I think is more convenient, and Dr. Buckley is going to do that introduction. And now I'm going to talk to Dr. Buckley in his own words. Very brief. I was born in Toronto, and went to med school and did my urology residence at University of Toronto. I've been working at NYGH since 1985. I'm currently chief of urology. Together with Andrew Labra and in partnership with Sunnybrook Hospital in Mantaman, we opened the Gale and Graham Wright Prostate Center at the Branson Hospital in June 2007. I know that I indicated Dr. Maker's bio fairly brief, and he took me very seriously. So I'll talk about it without much further ado.
Thank you very much, Winston. It's a pleasure to be here. We did a talk a couple years ago on Prostate Cancer 101, a brief overview, and it's quite a pleasure to talk about prostate cancer. At North York General, we have a prostate center at the Branson Division, and we see quite a few prostate cancer patients. So tonight we're doing a little project with two of my good friends and colleagues, Dr. Dennis McDonald and Dr. Irv Jacobs. Dennis is the head pathologist and chief of the laboratory medicine at North York General. And Irv Jacobs is the head of the chief of the radiography department also at North York General. So Dennis was born in South Africa, I believe, and did his training in South Africa in Queens and Toronto. And Irv did his training here at University of Toronto, but also some down in the States. So at the importance of, when I was talking with Aaron Thatcher earlier, or actually later in 2010, we thought of a topic, and we thought this would be very instrumental, because it's really the pathologist and the radiologist that is very key to deciding what mode of treatment that one might undergo when one gets diagnosed with prostate cancer, whether it is watching it, treating with surgery or radiation or some of the new other modalities. These two specialties are very, very key. So at our prostate center, we work in union with each other. Dr. Jacobs does the biopsies. Dr. McDonald reads the tissue. So we're going to be going through that and sort of giving you an understanding of the tissue and the other tests. So I'm going to start with a general overview of prostate cancer and what leads to doing a truss biopsy, which is the most common way that one is diagnosed with prostate cancer. Dennis McDonald is going to be going over the pathology report, how that's determined, and what changes are coming in the future. And then once one gets that tissue analysis, what other steps are done? So Irv Jacobs is going to go through the actual biopsy procedure itself, what one sees, and then the images on different types of scanning that one might do after that. We'll take a little break after that, and then we'll be entertaining some questions and hopefully answering those questions. So this is, we all three of us work at North Arc General. I'd like to point out that that's one of the radiologist cars. So they obviously must be doing very well. And this is our prostate center at the Branson McGill Graham Wright Prostate Center that all three of us work at. You notice that it's not today's picture because there's sun on all the forecasts. I think it's going to be a little rainy and maybe even snowy tonight, depending on the temperature. So, the basics of prostate cancer. It's the most common cancer in males, and it's the second leading cause of cancer deaths in males. 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 lifetime risk of males getting prostate cancer. So it's really quite a high incidence of prostate cancer. Quite a few deaths per year. There's a common misperception that it's a benign disease, and that's true. Quite a few of these have a very long latency period, but quite a few men do succumb to prostate cancer. It's increasing in incidence for various reasons. The population is aging. We're certainly picking up more with PSA testing, and virtually everybody has a friend or a family member that's been affected by prostate cancer. So what is the prostate? It's a gland that is just in males. It's located right below the urinary bladder. Its basic purpose in life is just to produce the ejaculate, and it helps with urinary control. And one can see right below the urinary bladder, there's the prostate. The urethra and the urine go right through the middle of the prostate gland. Just another diagram. So one can see when one does the rectal examination, you're really feeling the backside of the prostate gland. You can see the bulk of the prostate is actually in the back part of the prostate. So that's why a rectal examination, you really can't feel the front part of the prostate, but you can certainly feel a good part of it. So what happens with the prostate as one ages? Really three different processes. Everybody undergoes BPH, or the benign enlargement of the prostate. It occurs in virtually everybody after the age of 40 to 45. One can get infections of the prostate, and one can develop prostate cancer. All of these three are three separate conditions. If one has a benign enlargement of the prostate, doesn't necessarily means that that leads to prostate cancer. Three separate processes. So what are the typical prostate symptoms that one might experience? Going to the washroom often, having a sensation of urgency, slow stream, hesitancy is when it takes a while to initiate the stream. Nocturia is getting up in the middle of the night. And pain or blood in either the urine or the semen. Now, most of the prostate symptoms are actually due to the benign enlargement of the prostate. Prostate cancer actually very rarely produces any of these symptoms unless there's a real sizable component of cancer in the prostate gland. So most of these symptoms are attributable to that BPH process. So if one looks at the prostate cancer continuum, theoretically, it probably goes over decades where it may be initiated in the 30s, the 40s, or the 50s. It may develop some atypia, and then by the time it's localized and spreads metastatically and it becomes insensitive to that. This is really a several decades long process. So it's quite a long journey, and certainly as the population ages, we're going to have a sizable number of people at this end of this continuum. So what are the causes of prostate cancer? It certainly goes up with age. In autopsy series of people over the age of 80, at least 90% of people will have a small focus of prostate cancer that is usually well differentiated. So these are the prostate cancers that one lives with rather than dies of. Testosterone is the male hormone. It's theoretically linked to the development of prostate cancer, but interestingly, testosterone begins to decline around the age of 45, 50, 55. And really only humans and dogs, they're really the only two mammals that develop prostate cancer. Family history is very important. The most important factor is a brother that has prostate cancer, followed by a father or the father's brothers. There's also a relation genetically to breast cancer on the mother's side of the patient. The highest incidence is in North America. Is it related to our diet, environment? It's hard to say. Probably our diet certainly does take into account part of that development of prostate cancer, and increased saturated fat intake is associated with an increased incidence of prostate cancer. In the 90s, it was thought that perhaps a vasectomy was related to the development of prostate cancer, but that's shown not to be the case. There are certainly racial differences. African Americans have the highest rate of prostate cancer. Asian races have the lowest rate, and Caucasians are somewhere in the middle. If Asian races move to North America and they spend a generation, their incidence of prostate cancer increases. So how do we detect prostate cancer? And there's really a number of ways. The digital rectal examination is important, but in reality, the PSA blood test really picks up the vast bulk of these diseases. One can do a transrectal ultrasound, which Dr. Jacob is going to be describing, and certainly some of the prostate tissue that one gets from a scraping of the prostate for a benignly enlarged gland is routinely analyzed and made. Show some prostate cancer. So hopefully all rectal examinations aren't quite like this. So before we had PSA testing, which really is still in its evolution, there are still a number of people that are just getting their PSA test for the first time. And with the man-to-man and PCCN, with greater education, hopefully we're getting more people to be PSA screened. But before that became to be widely used, approximately 40% of people that had prostate cancer presented with disease into their bones, and only a small percentage really had localized disease that we could really treat locally. So the treatment in the 80s and before that was really hormonal or palliative. So the PSA, the prostate-specific antigen, in a way, it's a little bit of a misnomer because of the word specific. It really is not specific for prostate cancer. It's just a protein that is produced by prostate epithelial cells. The levels are typically very low, but people that have an enlargement of the prostate or any kind of infection or inflammation will secrete more of this protein. A lot of people are PSA secretors or leakers. They just make more of this protein than other people. And certainly prostate cancer is one thing that can be caused because prostate cancer cells, on average, produce a little more PSA than benign cells. So the way I look at it really is a statistical tool that if the PSA is elevated, the odds of there being some prostate cancer goes higher. And it's a very linear relationship. The higher the PSA level, the greater the odds of having some underlying prostate cancer. But it's not specific for it. So how do we use PSA? We use the PSA in relationship to the size of the prostate. A bigger prostate is going to produce more PSA. We look at the PSA velocity, which is the change in PSA from year to year, and how it's going up. A free to total PSA ratio, which is very commonly used if there is an elevated PSA, sort of helps as a statistical tool to need one to do a biopsy. There are another couple of other types of PSA that were done in the early part of this decade, but they aren't used anymore. One of the new markers is PCA3, which is a urinary marker. Oral doesn't cover it for $400. It's a little more specific than PSA and may help in one determine whether to move forward with a chest biopsy or not. The real key is probably getting a more specific marker that will be specifically related to prostate cancer. There are about 15 biomarkers that are being investigated around the world, but practically speaking, at the moment, there isn't anything available. So we're really left with the rectal examination and the PSA blood test. So we used to use a cutoff of 4 as sort of below that was normal, 4 to 10 was a gray zone, and greater than 10 was quite specific for it. We now know that, as I say, it's a linear curve. Lots of people have normal PSAs but have prostate cancer, and lots of men have high PSAs but don't have prostate cancer. So who do we send for a biopsy? Certainly a family history on the male side is one key thing. A PSA that's rising greater than 0.75 per year is another key point. But one should always repeat PSA testing because there is some day-to-day fluctuation. When one does the free to total ratio, a ratio of less than 0.10 is somewhat suspicious, so it may lead one to do a biopsy rather than watch. And a PSA doubling within a year is certainly another factor that takes into account that may lead us to do a biopsy. Just anxiety about the disease process is another reason to move forward with this. So this is our, again, our prostate center. This is Dr. Flax, one of our urologists, and Dr. Jacobs is going to be going into describing the ultrasound machine and how the biopsy is done. Everything is done digitally on PACS and consent from institution to institution. When one goes through this process and has this disease, you may see one of our colleagues, Dr. Morton, who works at Sunbrook. And these are one of the very key people that sort of helped us develop our center, Robert and Aaron, who are there to sort of help support and counsel people. So right now, I'd like to take a chance to introduce Dr. McDonald. And I'm going to hand over the speaker to him. And we're going to go through what is involved with the tissue, the pathological analysis of the tissue, and then we'll hand over to Dr. Jacobs for doing the biopsy and subsequent radiology tests.
Good evening. I'd like to thank Roger for the invitation to come tonight and talk to you about the role of pathology. We're a very important part of your treatment team, people that you don't often meet, but we work behind so-called the scene to provide very important and actually critical information to your physician, to your urologist, who will help guide which path of therapy you will go down if the biopsy has turned out to be positive indeed. Many of the biopsies, as Roger's alluded to, are not positive, and that's a relief to everyone. But if it is positive, we'll go through some of the criteria that will be of very important, great importance in determining that treatment path. So the other item I'd like to bring is also we're a friendly group. We don't bring any needles or scalpels or anything else. We just bring our eyes and our microscope. So we're non-invasive. Herb is going to go into the details of how the actual core is obtained, but this is an example of a core biopsy of the prostate gland, which has been processed and has been mounted on a slide and is what we examine with great detail to determine the diagnosis. And obviously, this being a pathology talk, I will be showing you some slides of the prostate gland, but we'll be going through them in probably as illustrative as possible to all the points in the gland. Now, Roger showed you the walnut-sized upper prostate gland. This is a schematic of the prostate gland, and the biopsy sites on this view, there's four other biopsy sites in the central zone that Irv and his colleagues obtain usually 10 cores. Now, each core, as you can see, represents a very small amount of the gland, and I'll come back to that point later on here. But the role of the pathologist, which I'm primarily going to discuss tonight, is to establish the primary diagnosis. So if Roger, one of his colleagues, brings the patient forward to be biopsied, we have to establish what is the reason for the elevated PSA. Is it a good reason, like so-called benign? And there are approximately about 21 conditions that we have to think about in our heads when we're looking at a prostate biopsy that can possibly cause changes to the prostate gland that are so-called good in the sense that they are benign. On the other hand, if it's bad, i.e. malignant, it's a malignant diagnosis that we make, the next step that we have to go on is to determine how ugly it is. So how bad is this malignancy that the patient does have? So it's a good, the bad, the ugly part of our work that we do. I'm going to spend a few slides, quite a number of slides, talking about the grading of the tumor if it is positive. And that is the so-called Gleason score that many of you are familiar with, and we'll spend quite a bit of time detailing that. The other important thing that we have to do is to determine the extent of the tumor based on the involvement of the biopsy core. And as noted, there's usually 10 cores obtained, so each of these 10 cores is examined in three different slides. So there are three sections made of each of these cores, i.e. about 30 slides to be examined. And then we determine if indeed this patient does have carcinoma. And then we have to determine on each core what the extent of involvement is. That's important for determining a therapeutic option for the patient. But one of the reasons why, because it's this representation, is often, although that we may see a very small amount of tumor on a patient's biopsy, say they do 10 biopsies, only one comes back positive, say 20% of that particular core, there's actually no correlation between that 20% and if that patient goes to surgery and has the entire prostate removed, and we examine it subsequently, there may be significant amounts of tumor in the prostate. So sometimes you'll see on your reports or if others have read about it, there's no real correlation between the amount of tumor that we discover on the biopsy and what is subsequently discovered. Roger mentioned about the prostate center. Last year we saw approximately 672 patients. Each of those has 10 biopsies, so that's 6,700 biopsies. We've cut three slides on each, and that's about 20,000 slides. So I'm just pointing this out because we are actually one of the busiest hospitals in the city when it comes to prostate pathology, or prostate cases, in fact. So this is important in the sense that we do develop a degree of expertise in looking at prostate biopsies. Roger may have mentioned that I have set all of them. That would be rather impossible. I do have eight other colleagues who help me. Now, I'm going to go through a couple of slides here because I think it's important for the understanding of when we talk about terms of care and carcinoma, etc. We see what actually goes on in the prostate once we've examined it under the microscope. Now, normal prostate histology is the appearance of the tissues under the microscope. The prostate is composed of glands, and this part is the stroma between the glands. Now, 90% or 96% of all carcinomas will arise between these glands. So these are the important ones that are to be examined. Now, the prostate, as Roger also mentioned, is a hormonally dependent organ. So depending on the age of the patient, the number and the size of the glands will vary because of the hormonal influence on these glands. The normal glands have this type of appearance, a large undulating type of glands, and they have what we call a benign cytology. So benign means that this is non-malignant, it's nothing to be concerned about in the sense of having an impact on my lifespan. Now, a couple of important criteria that we use in establishing the diagnosis: on the left panel here is a blown up or a high magnification of a normal gland of the prostate. And these have a type of appearance of piano keys, in a sense. These are the nuclei, they're often at the base of the cell, and then the cytoplasm, these are the cells that excrete the semen that we need for the ejaculate. So these are the secretory types of cells, and then the nuclei are lined at the base. So this is a type of organized pattern, one that we look at under low magnification to see, does this prostate gland look normal or not? And this is what we're examining this for. And on the right panel is an example of one of these glands stained up with one of the special stains that we utilize in determining the diagnosis of prostate cancer, because we're looking for this brown staining around the periphery of the gland. These are the so-called basal cells of the gland. They are very important when we look for a cancer or carcinoma. I use the term synonymously, cancer carcinoma, because one of the criteria for determining malignancy is the absence of these glands. And I know sometimes we get calls from the prostate center asking for the results of a biopsy, etc. Doing these special stains does add some delay to getting the report out, but they're very important in cases where we're not quite sure of what the diagnosis is. Now, this is an example of, again, our normal pattern, and on this panel is an example of a carcinoma. One can immediately see the difference between the glands. These have this different sizes. They have this what we call an infiltrate. That means it's kind of going through the tissues pattern, which is another very important criteria for establishing the diagnosis of cancer. And I'm just going to blow that picture up, or we call blow it up, and it's higher magnification, not the color term. But one can see that the third criteria we use is the presence of changes to the cells themselves. Remember that normal piano key type of appearance in the normal gland? These cells are very different. These cells have undergone malignant transformation. They are now cancer cells, and they show what we call features of pleomorphism, anaphrasia, etc. These are pathological terms, but they really imply that the tumor is growing and is displaying these very atypical features, these very prominent little structures in the cell, or what we call nucleoli, and that's the third criteria that we use. So we use an infiltrative pattern at the low power, we use the presence of these very atypical cells at high power, and then sometimes we use the lack of the basal cells to make the diagnosis, because we're always thinking, trying not to make the diagnosis of cancer. Making the diagnosis of cancer, we know, is a very critical aspect to anybody's life. So it's something that we do in the sense of, can this be anything but cancer, or what is this causing the change in the prostate? Now, I'm just going to show you on this slide, I'm going to go through the slide a little slower, because this is a hypothetical data set of populations of quantitative data. Say, for example, we tested this side of the audience who we know were normal, and this side of the audience we knew had cancer proven on biopsy. And we tested your PSA and your PSA. So in this quantitative set, we could find that the normal population would have a curve similar to this. And the patients with cancer would perhaps have two different curves. We could say, for example, the first curve would be this blue curve over here. So when we extrapolate this type of illustration to making a qualitative, which is means we use qualitative features, this diagnosis of carcinoma is made by a pathologist. It's not made by a machine. It's not made by using a number. But you can see that certain in the cancer, certain patients have very typical normal features, no problem making diagnosis. On this hand, patients have very typical features of cancer, no problem making a diagnosis. But if we use the blue curve, you can see over here where there's an overlap. These are the areas that we have a problem in. And if we use, for example, the hypothetical red curve, we can see that there's even a greater degree of overlap. So it's this gray zone here in this area, for example, that causes us diagnostic difficulty. And these are the ones that we more agonize about and think about and consult with our colleagues about. Now, of course, making the diagnosis of prostate carcinoma or any other condition is a qualitative diagnosis, i.e., it's made by interpretation of the features underneath the microscope, looking at the signs of the patient. So it's an interpretive science, and it's made by a human. It's a very important aspect to those two statements, because a machine is not spitting out a diagnosis. It's a human looking at this using his or her knowledge, skills, expertise, etc., to establish the diagnosis. And it's important to say that when we have disagreement, it doesn't imply that there's an error. I know that there's been a number of media reports, etc., about pathology and errors and people making errors, etc., in various locations throughout Ontario and throughout the country, in fact. But it's important to recognize that disagreement is not error, because experts can disagree. So it's, what is the truth? It's very sometimes not that clear-cut, black and white is one of the things. As I pointed out, there are areas of overlap. I'm not quite sure. Has this patient reached the degree of atypia required for the diagnosis of cancer? You agonize about it. If you're looking at it on late in the afternoon, you think, well, I'll push this one aside. I'll come back to it tomorrow with fresh eyes. I'll look at it again to make sure. If I'm not quite sure, we have in our department, we have a microscope like this that actually has about 10 what we call heads. We will call the microscope heads. So each day, all eight of us or whoever's around, we'll look at these cases that one's not quite sure of. And we'll bounce cases off each other. So it implies that not only do we see the cases that we actually sign out, but we see a lot of cases that our colleagues are agonizing about as well. And if we can't make up our definitive diagnosis, then we'll send it out to a well-known expert, a recognized expert in the city or beyond the city. And that leads us to another important topic of whose expert do you actually listen to? Your expert or my expert? Because experts differ in their interpretations just as well. They're humans, they render an opinion. This doesn't mean that I'm the greatest pathologist in the world, that his or her diagnosis is always the correct one. Because what we can sometimes see in our practice is that on this hand, this pathologist will say X, we'll send it to another so-called expert on that hand, and he or she will say Y. And they both may be right. And it's a little difficult to see which course will follow. And often in our reports, we will provide that type of ambiguity, not quite sure, so-and-so says so-and-so, so-and-so says so-and-so. Because this type of difference of opinion we can see in our city, and this we can see in various practices. You know that certain West Coast groups are more aggressive in making the diagnosis. Some of the East Coast groups may be less aggressive. So if you send it to the West Coast, you'll get a diagnosis of cancer. If you send it to the East Coast, you might not get that same diagnosis. So it's important when analyzing and looking at reports about errors to understand that. Of course, some of our beloved experts are equipped with rather large egos as well. So many of them will say, well, my opinion is the best and nobody else counts. And you have to listen to me. Now, being pathologists, we have to show you a few what's so-called icky pictures or whatever. These are not that icky, but in terms of what we call the gross examination, this is the prostate when Roger takes it out as a radical prostate picture. This is what it looks like, fresh from the operating room. It has this walnut size adherence to it, the stemmer vesicles in here. And what we do with it in the pathology laboratory is examine it quite diligently with our eyes, our naked eyes. We paint the surface with special stains to determine if there is cancer, how far it has extended. And then we fix it and prepare it, and then we cut it, and you can see these are sections of that, of the prostate gland. And as Roger pointed out, this is what we call benign prostatic hyperplasia. And obviously a man with such a prostate is going to visit the washroom a lot. And can immediately appreciate that this is pushing up on the bladder, it's impinging on the urethra. So you're going to have trouble peeing with a prostate that looks like this. Full of these nodules, and this is often a central type of disease here. On the other hand, this picture is another prostate, which has been cut section from on a whole section, and one can immediately see that on this panel here, there's a difference in texture and color. This is a big cancer sitting in the peripheral zone, and this will be obviously very carefully examined to see what extent the cancer is. Now I'll move on to discussing the Gleason score, which is, I'm sorry, this is black at the bottom here, I probably can't see it, but Donald Gleason was a pathologist at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Minneapolis in the 60s, and he developed this classification scheme back then, and it's quite amazing that this classification scheme has lasted 45 years in medicine. It's one of the few examples of a schema that has endured throughout all these advances that we've had since the 60s. But in the 60s, as Roger pointed out, there was no PSA, there was no needle biopsies, there were no herbs going around biopsying the prostate, there was no immunohistochemistry or those special stains, and about 90% of men had advanced disease. So a lot of men, when I was a resident, we didn't see needle biopsies. We saw a lot of men coming with advanced bone disease, their prostate had cancer had spread way beyond the prostate. So it was amazing that Gleason did this in the 60s, and it has, this is in fact one of his, he hand drew the classification, and it's something that we all have in our, stuck up in our offices, and we all consulted quite frequently when we're examining prostate cases. And I'm going to go through this in subsequent slides to show you the patterns that change from an almost normal appearance at the top to a very aggressive, very advanced type of cancer at the bottom. We call that going through stages one, or patterns one, two, three, four, and five. So what Gleason did, which is almost unique to many of the classification systems that we use in all types of cancers of various types, is that it uses only the pattern. It uses only low power appearance of the tumor. It doesn't involve any other fancy techniques or any other modalities that we use for breast cancer or other types of cancer, etc. Only the pattern. And we want to see what is the, if we have a positive biopsy, what is the primary pattern? What is the predominant pattern there? Is it a two pattern, a three pattern, a four, or a five? And if indeed there's a secondary pattern, is that a four or a five? And then the relative proportions of each. And the primary pattern is obviously more than 50% or greater, the greatest amount of tissue involved with the so-called primary pattern. We put those together and we come up with a Gleason score. Now, if the entire tumor looks the same, then it's all like this, and I'm going to go over these in more detail, we call that a 3 and a 3. So that makes a 6. In these two types here, we almost never make a diagnosis of a 2 plus 2 or any time bringing the digit 2 in the report. It's almost never going to see that. 90% of cancers will be in this range here, either a 3 or a 4. So it's going to be a 3 and a 3, or a 3 and a 4, or a 4 and a 3. Those are the type of combinations. Now, there may be, to complicate all these things, there may be a third pattern as well. Maybe I'll allude to that a little later on. But for the main part, Gleason set out in his grading scheme what is the primary pattern and what is the secondary pattern, put those together and come up with a score. that's something that you've had reports or you have pathology reports, you see your Gleason score. What is it, 7 out of 7? Well, it's not something to talk about, I suppose, but a 6 or a 7, etc. This is a schematic using Krispy Kreme donuts. I don't know if you remember the time when Krispy Kreme had tried to come into Tim Hortons territory. It didn't do that well, and obviously retreated back south of the border. I'm not quite sure it's actually doing that well south of the border either. But it, a couple of years ago, they used to try and sell you Krispy Kreme donuts. And what one of the eminent specialists in prostate pathology, David Bostwick, who was alluded to things, alluded to on the slide that's missing, he attempted to create a schematic for the Gleason score using donuts. And I'm not sure where the first one went, because if you put it in, because what it shows, what it would show is that the donuts here are very close to each other, they're all together, they're all similar size, they're very uniform in appearance, it's almost normal. And the grade of pattern 1 is almost a normal prostate, it's something a bit more crowded. Pattern 2, again, is close to normal, and then one sees changes in the glands that they become almost what we call varying in size and shape. So these are kind of normal small glands, and then you're getting these larger types of glands. But again, they're all well distributed from each other. They're not together, they're not what we call fusing together. As we see in this example, where a patient has moved from the 3, say, pattern into a 4 pattern. Now the glands are actually fusing together. We call this fusion together, the two donuts have actually come together. This one here is almost losing that kind of pattern, becoming a more solid appearance. This one's losing that pattern again. This one has this kind of a crisscross, hot cross bun appearance, very typical of pattern 4. And this again shows that type of where the glands have come together in this fused kind of pattern. It's a very typical pattern 4. So we had the majority of the tumor in the previous slide, and then we had a minority of the tumor showing this type of pattern. We call this a 3 and a 4, so a total Gleason score of 7. Now the next pattern is number 5, the worst, which now shows that the glands are almost totally disintegrated in the sense they're not forming glands anymore. We call this poor differentiation. They're becoming single cells and permeating through the tissue in a very invasive fashion. Many of the glands have a type of appearance in the middle we call necrosis, a very important pattern. So if one sees this type of pattern in the pattern 5, it's a very advanced pattern, and it's a one of obviously a very aggressive type of disease. Another slide is missing, I'm afraid, because when we take the two patterns together, to create a score, we realize that this has a very big impact on patient survival. And one of the missing slides here shows the difference of the patterns versus the survival. Once one moves from a 3 and 3 or 6 into a 7, 8, there's quite a difference in survival pattern. So we are very careful in establishing the diagnosis of 4, because once we bring in the 4 pattern into the score, it changes what the urologist will be doing with the patient. If the patient does go to radical prostatectomy, another important part of our work is to look at that prostate gland and determine if the tumor is one side or this side or both sides, i.e. taking what we call the stage of it, the region, and also again, as it extended beyond the prostate gland. Very important to establish that the tumor is either within the gland totally or has it gone beyond the gland, because obviously going beyond the gland like that establishes the pattern or the process of what we call metastatic disease. Last two slides, I'm just going to show you some types of terms you may have seen, what we call atypical ASAP, that is with ASAP, suspicious but not diagnostic of malignancy. So because of the increase in the number of PSAs being done, what we